CliffCentral.com. All right, time for us to get stuck into the second hour of this morning's show. It's 28th of November, 30 days, September, April, June, and November. Yeah, so tomorrow, Thursday, is the last day of this month. Then, so Friday's the first? Am I... you need the microphone in front of you, Buckabantu. He's like, yeah, no one can hear him. Okay, very good. At least you're paying attention. did you see over the weekend, this is quite a big story. Apparently, the Patriotic Alliance had a 10th anniversary celebration. First of all, I didn't even know they were 10.
I thought they were like 2 years old or
something.
Yeah,
I thought they were, yeah, please. Weren't they just pre-COVID?
Yeah.
So clearly they're 10 years old. They had a birthday celebration that was expecting a crowd of 25,000 supporters. Do you know how many people pitched up?
What, like 20?
No.
5,000.
Less than 5,000.
That is embarrassing.
And it was scheduled to start at 1 p.m. After 5 p.m. it eventually commenced, leaving supporters complaining of hunger and dehydration.
Yeah.
Gayton McKenzie expressed regret at the disappointment, acknowledging logistical issues that led people leaving for food but unable to re-enter due to restrictions.
But isn't this like a great isn't this a great audition to run the country? You can't even run it.
Yeah, I mean, you see, this is the problem, is like people read stuff into it that isn't just around party support. It's bad enough if you have an event and nobody pitches. That's like if somebody, you know, invites all their friends, but none of their friends come. You're like, they're not really your friends.
Yep.
He accepted responsibility for the organizational problems, including breakdowns of buses meant to support transport supporters. He promised to rectify the situation by hosting another celebration within 90 days. Are they going to come to another one since this one was done so badly? Despite the setback, he urged supporters to focus on upcoming elections and expressed gratitude to those who endured the challenges of the event. So basically a disaster. It was at Orlando Stadium and it was just really bad. Really, really bad.
I have a couple of questions here, right? Okay. So like I said, this is a great audition to run a country, right? So you can't fill up a stadium with 25,000 people. So you can't run a country of 62 million. Done.
Yeah.
Number two.
I don't think that's unfair.
The 5,000 people that were there, Gareth, complained of dehydration and hunger.
Yeah. So basically you're going to put them in a worse position than they are under the ANC.
Thank you.
Oh, man, it's just, it's very bad.
Yeah. So even the people who want to support you, you can't even provide for them.
Plus, let's not forget Kenny Kunene, who's like the 2IC in there. He was eating sushi off of women not so long
exactly.
ago.
Exactly.
Let them eat cake while I have sushi. Is that basically the message here? I don't know. Are we being unfair? Is this unkind of us? I don't know.
Yeah, dude. I guess so. I guess so. What, is my sound there?
Yeah, you're fine.
Cool.
Don't worry, I've got that under control. So Gayton McKenzie, embarrassing at very least. You could say lots about him, but embarrassing is probably the top line here.
Yep.
And then this heat wave, and it has been a heat wave. Yeah. I don't care what anyone says. I've suffered through it myself over the last few days. I have basically been walking around without a shirt on, which is not a pleasant idea. I mean, I'm not in perfect shape, believe me. But I've been walking around just because it's impossible at home. With this heat, it's stifling. You can't move around. I don't know about you, but I don't have air conditioning in my house.
Yeah, I also don't.
And a fan just makes the hot air go around, right? Joburg's water systems experienced strain due to a recent heat wave. Stage 6 load shedding added to that, causing disruptions in places like Roodepoort and Sandton, where some towers faced low water levels.
Okay, Gareth, so I have a bone to pick with this story, right? So I get natural disasters, right? So in this case, water system, you guys are excused. But there's always an excuse, though. So even the real ones come off as disingenuous. Like last week, it was, oh, you guys didn't have electricity. Oh, that other week, low reservoir supply.
I agree with
you. It's always something.
There's always something. And it's never us. It's never just like, oh shit, we really messed up.
Yeah. Oh no, we can't run this.
I'd love a little bit of humility from municipalities, from government, national government. Someone taking responsibility and going, you know what? This is actually my fault. You never hear that.
Yeah.
Ever. You have to beg these people to admit that they've done something wrong. Carl says we put an aircon in our room. Best thing ever. Yeah, maybe I should do that, hey? It's expensive, though, but it's probably worth it.
Yeah.
Gee, this is freaking normal, says... is this freaking normal, says Max Sony. Last year, the average temperature was 26. This time around, 35.
Yeah. Are you, more. Max Sony, are you saying the end is nigh?
Yeah, you've been saying that for a while.
But like, so I've been getting a lot of people telling me about how mosquitoes are this.
Oh, dude.
So number one, a lot of mosquito advice. So apparently if you switch on your aircon, they can't land because the air blows them away or something like that, or a fan or something, right? But people have been bombing my phone about they pollinate, apparently, Gareth.
They do. They pollinate they plants.
Yes. So I'm like, no, they like who needs them to?
I don't think so. We can manage with the bees, and the other insects.
I think we can slide by.
All the other insects can do that stuff for us. We do not need mosquitoes. I would say total
nuclear
war.
We won't die. Yeah, we won't die.
Total nuclear war and mosquitoes.
Yeah. Maybe we don't get the biggest grapes in the world, but I'm good with that.
Yeah, we'll find other ways. Someone can artificially inseminate every flower if they need to. But we don't want mosquitoes. I'll do without them. Thank you very much. And then I saw this story. I don't know what you think of this, but Volkswagen CEO Thomas Schaefer expressed concerns over South Africa's waning appeal for car manufacturing, especially with global shifts to electric vehicles, citing issues like, what do you think? Power cuts?
Load shedding?
Rising labor costs? Problems with Transnet? The ports are still a disaster.
Yes.
As we speak. So now people are climbing into him saying, you know, like the government saying, oh, I can't believe VW would say this stuff. They're trying to run a business. They're not charity, although all these businesses do so much charity that you could easily be mistaken. You could easily be forgiven for mistaking them for being charity organizations. They have outreach programs and job incentive programs and training programs, but their actual business is making cars. And if you don't give them electricity or transport for the finished product or transport for goods that they need to make the finished product, how are they meant to stay in business?
You can't give them labor. You can't give them skilled labor because our education system is in the dump. You can't give them electricity to run their... They can't even expand their business and run EVs in this country because we have load shedding and we don't have a reliable electrical grid. We can't do anything in this country currently. There is no incentive for VW to stay.
So when he says this, he's not trying to start a fight. He's been asked a question probably and he has to answer it honestly by saying... I can't run a business this way. And now people are all upset with him. Anyway, he says, despite South Africa being a major manufacturing hub for VW supplying models to 38 markets, he highlighted all of these challenges. He emphasized the lack of incentives for electric vehicle production and purchases, with EVs facing a 7% higher tax than traditional vehicles. Now, that is just a money grab by government. There's no reason for them to be doing that. We don't sell a lot of electric vehicles into this country, but they want to tax people who are. So it seems to me like this is a completely perverse incentive system affecting affordability and investment potential. He says VW's plans to introduce 10 new electric models by 2026 and invest $200 billion may be hindered if South Africa doesn't pivot to EV production soon. So basically he's saying government... We want to invest money. We want to do more with you. But get your shit together.
Forget, you need favorable conditions to run a business, right?
Seems straightforward to me and to you.
Straightforward, yeah.
Ay, ay, ay. All right, joking atheist, because this is obviously the subject that's got everybody excited this morning. Mosquitoes are attracted to carbon dioxide in your breath. Fans, aircons, etc. disperses your breath.
This is the stuff I was getting yesterday.
People have got ideas, huh?
Oh, you know the wackiest one I heard was...
What?
Apparently there's a blood type that attracts mosquitoes. Apparently it's super juicy. So like, apparently I'm that blood type.
What is it?
Oh,
shit.
Uh-oh.
Oh, literally, oh, shit. Because I am too. Listen.
This is why we were complaining and no one else was.
So last night, it's too hot to be under blankets. It's too hot to be wearing t-shirts. these things buzzing around your head. What are you going to do? I had the fan on full. There was nothing more I could do. Couldn't open a window because then more of them come in. I couldn't sleep. 2.5 hours of sleep. I was ravaged this morning when I woke up. I'm still feeling a little bit rough. So good luck to anyone who runs into me today. It's going to be a very tough day for them. The UK give you tax rebates for driving EVs. Did you see the Toyota Hilux ad was banned in England because it shows Buckies driving through rivers? Really? God, these people. I mean, it's just amazing to me how we've been completely led by the nose by a bunch of idiots.
Experts, Gareth.
Experts in inverted commas, right? Experts. We're not interested in Mozzie 101. Just get them the fuck out, says Max Sony. Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Let's go to war with the mosquitoes. I don't have a lot of time for them. All right, you want to talk about something. There's an animal lover. Talk about stupid, like you can't drive a bucky through a river in an ad. Apparently an animal lover will be chaining himself to a dog kennel for 100 hours to raise funds and awareness about the plight of neglected animals. So, great cause.
Great cause.
I don't have a problem with that, but I don't care about this guy chaining himself to a dog kennel.
So this guy has done it before. I don't remember if you remember earlier in the year, right? He did 40 hours. Now he's doing 100 hours, right? So I don't know what that campaign did for him, but all I know is to a certain level, great cause. Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's attention grabbing here. Also, it's objectively dangerous. It's a heat wave. We just talked about it. And you're going to chain yourself to a dog kennel. It doesn't make sense.
Where is he going to do this?
Cape Town, obviously, Gareth.
Cape Town.
Obviously, Cape Town. Where do you think you do this?
I mean, even the dogs are going to look at him and go, like, what's wrong with you? Why are you doing this?
Why?
Listen, I think there's nothing more horrible than people mistreating dogs.
Yeah.
Or any animal for that matter.
Yeah.
But I don't know that we need him chained to this thing. Just, you know, if you see people that are mistreating the animals, say something.
Yeah, say something.
Just like you would if they were mistreating their wife or their children. Really? If you hear the neighbor, the wife screaming all the time.
No, there's got to be a level. I'm no Dr. Hanan by any means, but there's got to be a level of attention grabbing that these people do, from Greta Thunberg to up down to these people, where you think you doing this thing, like piggybacking off a great project,
yeah,
like on a great cause, and making it about you, takes away from the message. Like, what's the biggest story from this? Like, he's going to die from a heat stroke? That's his biggest wish, I'm sure.
Well, if he does, I feel like we kill two birds with one stone. I don't want him to, but if he dies, he dies. If you put yourself, you see, again, with activists or protesters or anybody who really feels like they have to do something drastic to bring attention to a subject or to a cause, if you accept the risk as part of what you're doing. Now, otherwise, people wouldn't pay attention to you. So if you're just, you know, chaining yourself to a kennel every day and people don't care, then that's a totally separate issue. But if you expect people to care because there's a risk involved, you're going to chain yourself for 100 hours to a kennel and hopefully someone will stop and give him water or something, right? But if he goes, he chose this. Now, no one's going to stop him.
Yeah.
Why should you?
Exactly.
Am I right?
Also, like, you know what's more brave? Like, go into the wherever the dogs are kept and free them.
Yeah, that's a brave thing to do.
That's a brave thing to do.
Actually, and take on the owners.
Yeah.
Who are mistreating the animals.
Exactly.
That's a good idea. Okay, and then a Black Friday spend report came out. Over 300,000 rand spent by one customer on Takealot alone.
Bruh.
And the highest sold item per unit in South Africa. What is it?
It's the most South African thing ever. It's Coca-Cola, Gareth. Those small little cans there of 300 mils of Coca-Cola.
And we were just talking about the sugar tax.
Exactly.
That's the thing that sold more than anything else.
And then the second thing was toilet paper, the 18-pack, yeah, 2-ply.
So people are being very utilitarian about this. They're not going out and buying luxury goods.
Yeah. And then the third thing, you're going to love this, Greg, like Ryan. Ryan is in the studio, everyone. Clip drift. So the Coke makes sense now.
Because we were wondering why people were buying Coke. Now we get it. Okay, so really, alcohol.
And the toilet paper to carry you from the Coke to the Clip Drift.
No, I'm thinking that first you hit the Clip Drift and Coke, and then the toilet paper comes in. That's unbelievable. And one guy spent 300,000 rand on Takealot.
Yes. I don't know what he bought.
No,
but
they
whatever,
won't tell us.
Yeah, they won't tell us, but like 300K. I don't know. But the highest item sold in South Africa was this travel pack for 800 grand.
What is that? What is in there?
I don't know. Like some travel set thing. He's going to go away. Like, I don't know if it's, yeah, it's an entire thing. Clearly, he didn't use a travel IT.
No.
He paid 100 grand for it.
All right. Carl says, have you seen that video of those activists who chained themselves to the sunflower oil truck instead of a proper oil truck? Lol. Yeah, those activists I have no time for.
Oh, stop the oil, Gary.
Let me start that again. According to Congo Chris, there aren't any mosquitoes in Cape Town. It's probably because the swampy cholera water that we have in Gauteng is causing the problem. Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe we do have filthy water systems.
Well, what do you mean maybe? We do.
It's a shame. I don't know if I want to even hear about this, but something bad happened. Max Sony says, a dog was surrendered to the SPCA on the weekend. He was lucky to have one of his nuts still hanging. They managed to save it. What the hell's wrong with people? Hey, I don't like seeing people abusing animals. I really don't. And maybe that is a good segue into our guest, yeah. Because sometimes people behave like animals, yeah. And sometimes they go to jail, but then they get released too soon. Now, I'm not saying this is the case with Oscar Pistorius, because I think he's been in there for his 10 years, which is certainly more than some people get. There's a whole lot of argument about some people getting more or less, depending. But we have a great guest here, Dr. Gerard Labuschagne, who is joining us this morning. He's going to tell us a little bit about how parole works. And also, he's got some particular cases he can share with us this morning. So, Gerard, very nice to see you. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. Nice to have you here. So, I mean, we've had you on the show before, and it's great to actually have you in studio in person this time around. You've got a lot of things on your mind this morning, but let's just give everybody a bit of background. You're a clinical psychologist, criminologist, advocate of the High Court, special interest in forensic and investigative psychology. Mm-hmm. You've worked with the South African police as the section head in the investigative psychology section, and you were the head profiler for the police. Now, for anyone who watches TV shows, these crime and investigation shows, they probably think you have the best job in the world because this is what they watch for entertainment. Is it anything like what you see on TV?
Hi, Gareth, and hi, well, everybody, and thanks a lot for having me.
No problem. It's not like that at all.
First, I don't do that work anymore. That's the one thing I left.
No, I know. But when you did?
I do other cool stuff now. But when I did, it was interesting because, TV creates the impression that profilers are running around chasing down bad guys, interviewing them, and they're at crime scenes and et cetera, et cetera.
And you have all these devices that can pick up everything that's been happening, and you got a perfect record.
Now, in reality, the majority of profilers aren't that involved in the actual investigation. They're not leading the investigation. They're not always interviewing suspects. Often it's more behind the scenes. But actually in South Africa, we did play a role that was actually more similar to what you see on TV in many respects because, we were employed as members of the South African Police Service. We weren't civilians. We had ranks. We had undergo basic training. So we were policemen and profilers, which often doesn't happen in other parts of the world. So we really did have a lot more involvement and access in the investigations. We could be at the autopsy. We could be interviewing suspects. We could be at the arrest.
In places like Europe, there's so much red tape and delineation of responsibility that the guy who does the autopsy has no idea who the guy is who's going to end up with the docket. And that guy has no idea of whether or not the investigating officer is going to be able to access these records and those records. And it's complicated and bureaucratic.
Yeah, I mean, if I just take the UK, for example, and they've got a brilliant profiling unit, but they're not actually in the police. I think they're part of the Home Office, and they're all civilians. So again, they're not allowed to sit in front of a suspect and participate. They can give suggestions, and they might be able to watch behind a one-way mirror, but they're not allowed to be involved because they aren't police. They're not allowed to attend the crime scene. So we didn't have those barriers here in South Africa. So that's why I say we in a way, did live the profiling life that's perhaps closer to what you see on TV compared to a lot of other people throughout the world doing this for law enforcement.
And has our system worked better is the question.
We've
Do we end up seeing more of these dangerous criminals put behind bars?
The unit has a very successful reputation. And again, it's not just us, you know, you've got the detectives, you've got the forensics people, you've got the prosecutor, all those lead to the success of any case.
Mm.
But we definitely had a very good reputation locally and internationally as for the work that we were doing, because we just had so much experience. You know, if I spoke to my colleagues overseas who are profilers in, say, one or two of the states in the US,
yeah,
in their whole career, they might have seen maybe 10 serial murder investigations would be a lot. Yeah, by the time I left, I stopped counting at 110 different murder series that I'd worked on. And wow, my colleagues who are still there have worked on more, right?
Yeah?
So we have massive amounts of experience. We do have certain things in South Africa that work well for serials. You know, in the United States, there's literally like 17,000 independent law enforcement agencies. That little PD in that, you know, in that little town is its own law enforcement agency. They have their own policy. It's funded by the local taxes, tax money. Totally separate from – it's like having Santon SAPS being totally different to Midrand SAPS. It's like they don't have to talk to each other. They have different equipment. They have different procedures. And that's just kind of part of how the history of the U.S. developed. So we don't have that.
So it's far more decentralized.
Absolutely, which makes communication across boundaries far more difficult. And that little town is using its own DNA lab because they contract to this one because they were the cheapest.
Because, of course, criminals don't just stay in their jurisdiction, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen that.
Criminals move around, especially in this country.
Yeah. So the fact that we didn't have that in South Africa means that we were able to have far more reach and systems that are applicable throughout the whole country. And so that's definitely been to our advantage in dealing with serial offenders. And that's, again, we've had a lot of success that when you do the right thing, which is put together a task team of people who know what they're doing, you almost always have a success. Does it always happen nowadays? Not necessarily the way I think it should be happening, but there is still that potential there.
All right. So how does parole work? You get sentenced by a judge. They give you a minimum sentence, put you behind bars. Whether or not that prison system works properly, we know from this whole Thabo Bester story that the prisons, I mean, that really opened up, and we actually spoke to the authors of the book that they've just written on the Thabo Bester saga. That shone daylight onto so much of what's wrong with our correctional services in South Africa, private and public. I mean, first of all, most South Africans, including me, didn't even know that there were private prisons in South Africa. So that was a big wake-up call. But you go into jail and then you serve your time. And what happens towards the end of your sentence?
I want to take it back to what you started off right now when you said the judge gives you a sentence. That judge or magistrate looks at various things. They look at it's about punishment deterrence so that you don't do it again or that other people see this and go.
And of course, just to be clear, so once you have been found guilty in the actual criminal trial, then there is a sentencing procedure where, again, the prosecutor and your defense attorney and advocate have to proffer reasons why something should be mitigating or aggravating in terms of your sentence. Like if you're particularly dangerous, nasty, vicious, angry, aggressive rapist, there are probably reasons why you should be kept in jail longer and your sentence should be extended. And if you are a first-time offender and you're some little old lady who is accused of driving into someone recklessly, you'll still go to jail, but they might mitigate your sentence.
Absolutely. So like I said, the judge is looking at different things when they decide what's the appropriate sentence. Like I said, it's punishment.
A judge has total discretion.
Yeah, it's punishment. It's deterrence that I don't do it again and that other people look at this and go, ooh, I don't want to try that. Look what happened to that person.
Mm.
It's got to do with rehabilitation, the offender, the prevalence of that crime in society. And those are all the things the judge or magistrate
is
looking
at. By the way, is rehabilitation even a subject of discussion in the South African context? I don't know that much. I've done a couple of shows from inside a prison, so I've seen what they look like. It doesn't look to me like it's the sort of place that you come out better than you go in South Africa.
I think if you want to, you will come out better.
Really?
But I don't think the system can make you better.
Yeah.
For various reasons. Yeah. A, it always ignore the best systems, and if the prison doesn't want to change, they're not going to change. But I also don't know if we have the best systems in place that could take those people who are not really interested and work on them to making them better people. So I have my questions about that and whether the programs we have are really just, you know, tick box exercises or are they really something that's going to make people change?
Okay, so to go back to sentencing. Yeah. So the judge has discretion. They decide then on the length of your sentence, which prison you're going to go to. What happens from there?
So that's what the judge decides when they say this is the appropriate sentence. in that time, obviously, you can do nothing if you don't want to. They supposedly do an assessment of it when you arrive and decide, okay, you need to go on a sexual offenders course. Do you need to go on a domestic violence course? I don't know how well that assessment is done and how evidence-based that initial assessment is done. But one of my biggest problems is that when you arrive at court, at prison, as a sentenced person, it's not like the case file goes with you. It's not like the judge's comments at judgment and sentencing so go with you. So literally very often all the prison knows is you've got a 15-year sentence for murder. Now you look at Oscar Pistorius as he was convicted of murder. Now you look at that couple in Velcom that took a guy to the graveyard, killed him, cut him up, kept body parts in the fridge. They were also convicted of murder.
Yeah, but they sound a lot more dangerous to me.
Exactly. So just knowing that someone's convicted of murder without knowing actually what's the case about, how do you know then what to do with that person? Because you're almost basically looking at what do they tell you about the case. And Donovan Woodley, who killed Lee Matthews, is a good example. You know, when he pled guilty, he said, you know, I knowingly killed her. I knew I couldn't let her go. I got her to get undressed, got her to turn around. I shot her in the back of the head five times. Shot from behind five times. That's like an assassination. Mm. What he's telling the parole board now is, you know, I was going to let her go and, you know, I wanted to get undressed.
And does the parole board have no idea about what actually happened?
They haven't got that information.
Who's on the parole board?
Why don't they get this information?
Wait a second. So, this is infuriating, and I can imagine how much more angry you are about this than anyone else. So there's a parole board. Is it the same parole board for everyone who's a prisoner in the country?
No, each area
we have different
prison
parole
would have its own parole board.
And how do we staff these parole boards? Are they just people who volunteer? Are they people who are appointed?
So there's two levels. You've got sort of the
They get paid?
I'm not sure they get paid. At the one level, the internal prison, which you'll have the psychologist doing an assessment, your social worker, you'll have the guy in charge of that section where the person's based. So you have like a small parole board, I think it's called the CMC, if I'm not mistaken. They kind of look and they give their recommendations to the parole board. Mm-hmm. Now, on the parole board, there's no professional people sitting. There's no psychologists, criminologists,
homeless people off the street.
So you have people who members of the community will sit on it. You'll have the parole
In other
board
words, people off the street.
Experts, in essence, you'll have a member of the SAPS is supposed to be sitting on this. There'll be a permanent member who's supposed to sit on each parole board. So they get the stuff from that first level internal prison kind of parole CMC, as they call it, where the experts are. And they get that information. They sit and they look at it and decide what's what. So that's my first big problem is how do you have a guy who has no background in psychology looking at a psychologist's report saying, A, it's a good or bad report, firstly. And then secondly, you'll get these bizarre recommendations. And I know a lot of correctional service psychologists who say, we get these bizarre recommendations back from the parole board as to what we must do for therapy. But it's like me telling an orthopedic surgeon, hey, buddy, you must fix that patella.
Just judging from what you've told me about these parole boards, if you say to some of these people that you're dealing with an aggressive, like nihilistic, just a homicidal maniac. Mm. They don't know what any of those words mean.
No.
Probably sitting there going, sounds like he's a great match for my daughter.
And I cannot tell you how many times, again, these correctional service psychologists that I've known just because I've been in the field for a long time who say to me, we will say there's no way in hell you can recommend release this person.
Yeah.
And they'll release them. And the parole board's view is, well, that's just one of the reports we look at to
like
make our
playing decisions. The lottery.
But it's kind of like a pretty important one. The psychologist is saying to you. And Morne Haramsa, the Krugersdorp sword killer from many years ago, is a good example where the own internal correctional services psychologist was saying, no way you can release this guy. They asked me to do an independent review, and I said, there's no way you can release this guy. He has far more risk factors than before he went to prison. They released him. So, I mean, if you look
it's almost like they
Twitter
go
page,
in the opposite direction of the advice.
Honestly, sometimes looks like I can only assume they don't know what they're doing.
Okay, but surely there has to be because we live in a very criminal society. South Africa is ravaged by crime and it's almost become uninteresting to talk about it now because it's just such an everyday experience for people. So you would think that once someone has gone through the processes and the criminal justice processes sometimes let us down, but these are the people who've gone through. They've been sentenced. They're then sitting in jail. And a bunch of amateurs who seem to volunteer themselves from off the street go in and knowingly disregard the advice of experts to release these people back into society, there must be a cost for those people who make those decisions.
Absolutely no consequences.
We need to know who they are. We want to know their names so that if those violent criminals get out and do something, they, as the parole board, are held responsible.
I absolutely think so, because now there's no consequences. If you bugger it up and this person who is a very bad candidate gets released, does something again, there's no consequences for those people. So my argument is we don't have any doubts assuming that there can be corruption in the police.
They should go to jail.
Or in the
prosecution. If you're on the parole board and someone gets out and they reoffend, and you were given advice from people who know the case to say, this is going to happen, this is a bad idea, do not let the sword murderer back onto the streets, and then he goes out and he murders someone with a sword, whole parole board should go to jail.
I think we'd have a lot less people getting parole. So that's my problem, is we don't question ever that there's possible corruption in policing and prosecutions. Now, how about people who can release you halfway through your sentence? Do we do any lifestyle audits on these people? Do we do polygraphs on these people? Because, my goodness, you don't think there's corruption there. And if you're not looking for it,
might be on tick.
You're allowing it to flourish if you're
it
not,
might
if
be
you
on,
don't have mechanisms in place.
Might be on your ban tick, for all we know.
So it's a huge – and they've continually been saying correctional services, they're going to revamp the system. Like, okay, when? And what are you doing? And who are you speaking to?
Who's the current minister?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Ronald Lamula.
Is correctional services back under justice?
I'm not sure.
Okay. I think so. Oh.
So they've been saying for years they're going to revamp the process. Like, okay, well, when? What are you doing about it? What have you started to do about it? Because who are you speaking to professionals about how this system should work? Because I don't think it's – I mean, I've sat in present, been present on a few of these parole board hearings, amongst others the Donovan Woodley, and I look at these things and I think this is a bloody circus.
But what reasons do they give? Is it just like a stamp of approval gone?
So in my experience, what correctional services really pays attention to is, do you show remorse? And have you behaved well since you've been in prison?
So if you just do a bit of acting.
So remorse is just me saying sorry,
I guess. It's my fault. I'm very sorry for how it impacted upon other people. And then tick box going through courses. Now, the problem is, as I said earlier, when the court sentences you, they look at punishment, deterrence, retribution, the prevalence. They look at a bunch of things when they say 15 years or 20 years. Correctional services only looks at remorse and if you've been well behaved. So my argument is, aren't you undermining the court if you're not considering all the other aspects?
Absolutely.
Because you might be rehabilitated 6 months into your sentence. If you killed your wife in a moment of anger, you had experienced a lot of issues in your life and you snapped, you might be rehabilitated in 6 months. But does that mean you finished being punished for your crime? So your punishment might can go longer than your minimum period of detention, which is that point where you can possibly get parole. So correctional service doesn't seem to look at, actually, we don't think you've finished being punished for what you did. The thing is, like, you can murder or rape five minor children, right? That's automatically five times life. They all start at the same moment. So in other words, your parole point is 25 years.
Consecutive.
So
they're not consecutive.
So essentially, you can theoretically get parole at 25 years, the same as someone who's got one life sentence. But should you at 25 years get parole if you've committed five murders of people, children, or in
I mean, that alone, there's no argument that those should be
They should be at least staggered, that at least the one kicks in 5 years after the previous one or 2 years. Otherwise, you're literally saying to people, go large, and if you get caught, have one trial, because you'll essentially get sentenced. That's why when people say, oh, the guy got 500 years. No, he didn't. If you add them all up, he got 500 years. But effectively, the maximum he might sit is 15
This
years.
Is maddening. I can't believe that it is this higgledy-piggledy and amateur. It's made up on the spot by people who are willfully, as you say, disregarding the hard work that the courts put in. All right. I mean, there's interesting stuff coming up in the comments. So Congo Chris says here that Glynis Breitenbach said the same thing. How could you not do lifestyle audits on correctional services officers who oversee gang leaders and criminals? That's a whole other discussion that came up in that Thabo Bester situation. When you know people in there and how the system does not work, you're helpless and it pains you, but it's insane. Max Sony says. So how easy is it to influence a parole board, especially if you're politically connected?
See, that's what we don't know. How open and amenable are they to influence? And like I said, like you point out, if you're not doing lifestyle audits, you're not doing polygraphs on people, you don't have active mechanisms in place to check for corruption in the parole boards or even the CMC board. then you've just allowed it to actually flourish if you're not looking for it and having mechanisms to prevent it. So that's my problem. And I mean, if you could, as I said, you've got the power to release someone halfway through their sentence. You're telling me you don't think there's any potential corruption there?
There's a simple answer here. I'm not an expert, sir, but like, it's so simple. Like, these people are not being held to account. There's no sense of accountability, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously they have no consequence, so they'll do it.
Yeah.
If I say 25 grand, even if I say 100 grand, just to what, stamp that paper approved?
Yeah. Yeah. But for some people in this country, they're desperate enough to do whatever.
I don't even think they do a review to say, right, every time someone offends again who was on parole, let's look at which parole board did it. Maybe you just find one particular parole board is either just very bad at doing it or potentially there's corruption. And either way, you need to look into that.
Consequences.
Yeah. Consequences.
Right, it doesn't just go away. All right, so let's talk about a couple of cases because you've been very involved in, and you have a great insight into the station strangler, Norman Simons, who was released on parole on the 20th of July. Mm. What's happened there?
Okay, well, first,
by the way, what is parole? Because people don't understand. Oh. They think parole means you've been released from prison and now you can just carry on with your life as if you were never in prison.
So let's start there. So obviously, as you said, the court gives you a sentence, whether it's a life sentence or a fixed 10 years or 15 years. Parole means that at some point in the duration of your sentence, you'll reach a period, usually for non-life people, it's halfway through, where you will start to have parole hearings. And that'll probably be at least every 2 years thereafter, where the board would say, like, do we think you are okay to be released back into the community? So you'll still continue serving the rest of your sentence, but in the community with very strict conditions, hopefully, that are monitored.
Would you have to check in?
Check in, you're not allowed to drink. You're not allowed to be out after five. You have to
come. How do they check that you can't drink?
I suppose they have to come and inspect you physically because that's the only way you can actually do it.
They do this? Who does these inspections?
I've had one guy who died in the police cells and apparently he still reported to his parole officer three times thereafter. So I don't know how well it's been monitored.
Jesus.
So that's what parole is. And parole is important because if we just let someone serve their full 10 years and then once they walk out the door, we have no control over them. We can't ask where they're going. Do they have a place to stay? So that's actually a recipe for failure. So I don't have a problem with parole, but I don't know if necessarily halfway through your sentence is a good idea. But maybe like if you've got a 15-year sentence, a year or two prior to that point, very strict conditions, you have to have a place to go to, and those people have to say, yes, we'll look after you and test you out. Because then if you bugger up, we can bring you back in.
Right.
So parole is actually very important. Halfway through your sentence, I don't know. I think that's just more to deal with overcrowding. So you continue with your sentence, but you're just serving it outside. If you mess up, you get brought back in and you'll continue to sit again until you get parole again. Maybe,
Jean
maybe
Valjean.
Not.
There we go.
So that's sort of what parole is.
Okay. In the case of Norman Simons, let's look at that one first.
Okay.
We can come back to Oscar Pistorius, who everyone's very excited about because he's been granted parole early next year. Mm-hmm. And we'll look at Liesel de Jager. That's that whole situation too. We'll get into that. So first of all, the station strangler, Norman Simons. Okay. Remind us of what happened here.
Okay, well, that's two loaded words. So so Norman Simons is typically referred to as the station strangler. Mm-hmm. He was only ever charged with one murder and convicted of one murder. They never charged him with any of the other murders that took place. And I mean, these were cases, I think about 19 cases that took place between 86, we had two murders of young boys. 87, there was five. 88, one. Then 94, there was a whole string of them. One, two, three, four, five, about, sorry, just quickly counting, about 11.
He was never convicted of any of those.
He was only charged with one.
Suspected from, of the for 1994. Charged with one.
So Jesus. That's the problem. So technically, one has to be very careful to refer to him as a station strangler because he will turn around and sue you and say, well, prove it. Because I was only ever charged with – with a bunch and convicted of one. I was only charged with one.
Yeah.
And if you even look at this, some interesting documentaries that were done about a couple of years ago, they interviewed the prosecutor who actually said, I didn't think we were even going to get a conviction on this one because it really hinged around eyewitness evidence at a lineup. And the witness kind of – well, I think it kind of looks like that guy. There was no forensic evidence against him. In fact, there was – two DNA from two different cases, probably the 90s cases, there was DNA samples found using old DNA technology. Because remember, 94, we didn't really even – SAPS didn't have DNA. You know, UCT was had to do the testing. And it was very primitive DNA testing. And those two samples didn't match Norman Simons. They matched each other.
Yeah.
We then had those retested using modern DNA technology. They still matched each other. There's two different crime scene samples. And they still didn't match Norman Simons.
Sure.
So we definitely know that there was another person who committed two of those murders.
Those copycat killings.
Well, that's if you want to assume that they were Simons was responsible.
Yes. Or maybe they were copycat.
And even when we looked at these cases in about 2010, we went back and tried to find other cases that occurred after Norman Simons was arrested. And we found a couple cases that actually matched very similar victimology, modus operandi, that clearly wasn't Norman Simons because he was already in custody.
Yeah.
So, A, to look at all these crimes and say that the work of one person without any forensic evidence, that's firstly, we can't assume. Well, we know that someone else, we've got the two DNA samples that aren't Simons from this so-called Station Strangler series. We know after Simons was convicted or in custody, there were other murder cases of children of this very similar circumstances. So that's the first concern. So I personally look at the Station Strangler series as an unsolved series, not as, you know. So that comes back to him now.
But I remember there was a lot of noise around release this guy. Activists were very involved in saying he's paid his price, let him out.
Yeah.
So what's happened there?
Look, I do think that everybody, I think even the parole process, they've looked at him as if he was the Station Strangler. They might not have been able to say it on paper because he served a hell of a lot more time than other people. Other people would have been released long ago. So I think that's unfair against him if he has, there's no evidence that he committed the other crimes. Like I said, I already mentioned the DNA that we know it wasn't him. Other cases after he was in custody. But most people aren't even aware of all the facts I'm telling you right now. So let's look at this. He was convicted of one. The appeal court reaffirmed that conviction. So we can't do anything about that. If he had behaved in prison well, he's done whatever courses that were expected of him, he should have been released when anybody else who'd committed a single child murder was released. If we start to say, I really don't like Norman Simons, he should sit for longer, then we're playing favoritism. Mm. And the problem is today favoritism leans this way, tomorrow it leans that way because of politics. Yeah. We have to have a scientific basis of how we give people parole. It cannot be, I don't like Yonis Vollis because of what he did, therefore we're going to make him sit.
Well, he was a very controversial,
exactly.
Came up just recently as a big story.
It's one example, Then we say, well, I like Oscar, he should get out. Well, if we're going to decide parole on who we like and who we don't like, that I don't think that's fair on anybody, society or the person who's being convicted. So there needs to be a bit more science in how we determine whether or not people be released, which I'm not seeing right now on the parole boards as we've
mentioned. And it seems to me that in society, just like during the trial, Oscar Pistorius has got big fans and big enemies and lots of people who absolutely hate him and think he should spend the rest of his life in jail.
Still till today.
And you could not possibly make him suffer enough. And then there are other people who say he's definitely done his time. It seems to have been a mistake, even if, there were all the factors that we know from the case about aggravating, bad temper, gun going off in restaurants, all that stuff. What do you think the man on the street has to say about this, and how wrong is the man on the street? Because that's often a subject worthy of discussion all on its own.
So whenever I talk about parole, I like to say, firstly, we can have our own personal views, like should someone who's taken the life of another ever get parole or ever be released? That's a separate argument. We have to look at how does it work now and what's the norm? Because if people aren't being treated by the norm standards, then we're using favoritism. Mm-hmm. So my personal view in Oscar Pistorius' case, I personally, from what I know, and I haven't done a formal risk assessment on him, I don't think he would be at a high risk again for doing this to a future partner. So if he's done what he was expected to have done in prison, if he has behaved well in prison, and if any other prisoner would have been released at this point in time, if they weren't Oscar Pistorius, then Oscar Pistorius should be released now. Again, this is setting aside the argument whether we feel if you've committed a murder, you should stay die in prison. But if he's done everything else that any other anonymous offender had done, the same stuff in terms of the crime and his behavior in prison, then he should be released.
Sure.
Otherwise, we're playing favoritism. And like I said, I don't think he's a high risk for reoffending, so I personally don't have so much of an issue. Because I find it interesting, we get very upset about this, but we don't care about the other people that we don't know about who are released daily for doing the same thing. So also, check your morals because you're upset because you know about this case, but you don't really give a damn about the other thousands that are going through the same process on a daily basis.
But people are not objective.
Yeah. No.
I mean, you've seen enough
Well, we're human beings. We're driven by emotions. We vote on our emotions, don't we? If we voted on logic, we would have a very different country.
Right.
So that's unfortunately how it is. So whether, as I said, we should have longer minimum sentences, that's an argument people can put forward and the politicians can argue, etc. But we have to have science in how we assess people's risk. I don't think we have that right now. We have to have professionals sitting on parole boards. We don't have that right now. Mm. And we have to be fair and even-handed, despite whether we really don't like someone or we like them. Because tomorrow, you or I are the one who's on the receiving end of this emotional decision-making. And then we will definitely be bitching and moaning about it.
So, can I ask something? Why isn't it the other way? Why if the court, we all know the judiciary is impartial, right? Or that's the aim. Why doesn't the court review? And then the parole board gives a recommendation to the court, and then the court decides.
I would love that. Firstly, it would swamp the courts because we have thousands of people coming out for parole. So the courts wouldn't be able to cope with that.
A friend of mine is an advocate, got a court date for one of his matters in 2027.
Yeah. Sure. So that would be the first
That's
problem.
That's the first opportunity he's going
to
have.
Even if it's just presented to a magistrate in chambers, it doesn't have to be a whole proceedings. Like some inquests, you know, the docket's presented to the magistrate and they read through it and make a finding. Ideally, yes. And there are certain cases if you are given an indeterminate sentence, you know, you're deemed to be a psychopath and it's been approved in court that you get an indeterminate sentence. In other words, we give you 20 years and then you have to go back to the court, not correctional services. And you have to convince the court, ideally the same judge if they're still alive, that you've been rehabilitated. And if you haven't, the court can say, well, sorry, another 10 years. Hmm. That's another thing. But it's very rarely used, I think, because at the end of a trial, they don't want to – I think everybody's just sick and tired of the case and they don't want to go that extra hoop. But that is one way which you can have it that a judge actually has to review whether or not you should be. So Sinead van Heerden, one of the Welkom murderers, she had an indeterminate sentence. Okay. So she has to appear before a judge after 20 years. And I think I would like that more because I think a judge at least would say, but show me your evidence that this person is, you know, and then there could be another side arguing against it. Mm. At the moment, when I went, for example, Donovan Woodley's parole, who in the Matthews family asked me to assist, I had prepared a report. I wasn't allowed to present that report. I wasn't allowed to speak. They said, no, sorry. No experts from outside because it undermines correctional services' own experts, which is a bit ironic because in the case of the sword killer, I was asked by correctional services psychologists to provide an independent report. So it's also as if sometimes these parole boards seem to make up their own rules, but they didn't want any external experts. So we had a forensic pathologist who looked at Donovan Woodley's – I mean, he's had so many versions of events from the time he pled guilty. And she said scientifically – what he is saying to explain this delay in decomposition between when he says he left the body and when the body was found is not scientifically possible. But we can't have that report submitted. We can't have people presenting contradictory evidence.
So Gerard, just tell me on Donovan Woodley, because it is such a fascinating case. And I think, you know, we've had we've had Lee Matthews' parents in here and we've had amazing discussions around, I mean, they're just the most extraordinarily solid and stoic people. And I don't know how they manage in the light of what happened. If anyone else's daughter had to have the same situation happen to her, I don't know that any of us would be as strong as they've been. But this Donovan Woodley is a hell of a character. And you've examined him at close quarters. You've actually seen the evidence change, you've seen his personality, you've observed his behavior. Mm. What do you think is going on there? Is he a total psychopath?
Well, that's a diagnosis and I would be forbidden to make that comment.
Okay, well, is he unhinged? Is he...
He's calculating. He changes his story and then he pretends as if that's all okay. But people don't know is that in between him pleading guilty to intentionally killing her, literally assassinating her when he realized he couldn't get away with it. And now he's had so many different versions of events in his own handwriting. Remember, he studied law in his own words so that he could handle his own appeals.
Yeah.
And he tried to get retrials and he tried to get appeals. And at one point it was like, yes, I accept what I did. I just think the sentence is too harsh. Then it's like, actually, it wasn't me. It was other guys who did it. They framed me to later on. I was an unfortunate passenger in this whole thing with other people. So he's changed his version so many times, like 180 degrees. And now he's back on, okay, it was me, but actually I was going to let it go and the gun went off by accident. It's almost like an Oscar Pistorius kind of defense. So we said, but you've changed all your versions. Oh, no, I accept responsibility for that. No, you haven't, because if you did, you realize you shouldn't get parole right now. Mm. So he chops and changes his stories and lies without batting an eyelid. Now, again, you can try and work that back to personality, to whatever you want to do, which I can't do diagnostically. But I can't see how there's any remorse. It's everything he's done has been self-serving. And if you go and study a whole LLB law degree, it's not because one day when you get released, you want to go be a lawyer, because you can't. You know, you want to, and as he said in his own papers, I did this solely because I could handle my legal. So you haven't done anything to improve yourself that could help you as a human being, yeah, or help you get a job after you one day maybe get released. You've done it solely because you wanted to get out of what you've done. So, I mean, that's just one good example where, and I mean, and quite frankly, I think he's going to get parole. He's taken the parole board to court a few times, but quite frankly, the parole board's behavior has been quite disgusting in the times I've sat in on two of his parole hearings. I mean, you've had people falling asleep. You've had people not understanding
really?
The information. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Again, these are regular Joes.
It's like a bloody circus. So I honestly think the court's eventually going to go back and say, all right, you guys have buggered up so much. We're going to order that he gets parole, get paroled. So I can see Donovan Woodley getting parole in the next year or so, to be honest with you.
Calculator.
Wow. He sounds like a terrible person. I mean, I just...
And he still hasn't explained what happened.
Where is he in jail?
Here in Johannesburg. Johannesburg Prison, Sun City, as they euphemistically call it.
Okay, so you know some of these things better than the rest of us do. Like, are there better prisons and worse prisons to be in?
Sure.
Because you've probably had to go and visit these people.
To be honest with you, I went to that Mongolian private prison, but many years ago in 2006 to interview a guy called Buti Boo, Stuart Wilkin. And I was very impressed with that prison, to be honest with you, how it was run, the professionalism of the people. Well, clearly, with Thabo Bester later on, things have changed. But I would probably say it's still better to be in one of those private prisons, probably, because they have certain limits on the number of people that they can have. Ironically, overseas, private prisons, you give the people with the best chance for rehabilitation. We put them in the private prisons. Here, unfortunately, it seems to be correctional services likes to use it as a dumping ground for the people that they don't want to work with. You know, problematic people, difficult people.
Oh, really?
And it should actually be the other way around. Yeah. You know, you want to get that best chance of rehabilitation to those ones who have the best chance of rehabilitation. Yeah. We don't seem to do that.
Okay. And again, if we go to the Liesel de Jager case, which is, I think, fascinating to a lot of people. So just explain this one to us again, because the guy who was accused of killing the pastor, revealed as her husband. Now, I don't know much about this case, but maybe you can fill in the gaps for us quickly, because there's a parole story here as well. Is that right?
For him?
Well, I don't know. So it's a man accused of killing KZN pastor Liesel de Jager has been revealed as her husband is the story in the news. That's surprised. As much as we have now. First of all, it's often the case that people in South Africa think that crime is always opportunistic. Mm. It can be. Mm. But very much more often than people would be comfortable to admit, most of the violent crime in this country is conducted by people who know each other on people who know the person who's
same with sex
committing
crimes.
The crime.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this is a very scary reality that we have to face up to, because we like to say, oh, well, the government have no control over crime and the police and the criminal justice system and, you know, the courts let people off. A lot of these horrible, horrible things are happening with people who are familiar with each other.
Absolutely, yeah.
So there's a social ill at the bottom of all of this that's actually the disease, and all of these things are actually symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, like I said, sexual offenses, most of the time it's people known to the victim. Rape crimes, well, that's a sexual offense, obviously, known to the victims. Most murders, the victim is known to the suspect. So, yes, like you said, we get the opportunistic hijacking. We're just in the wrong place, in the right car at the wrong place at the wrong time. And... But most of it, we know our offenders.
Okay, can I just touch on something here? Like, when we were talking about prisons, it got me thinking about, so in these prisons, right, what is your best chance of rehabilitation from a psychological point of view? Can you enter and become worse?
Yeah, you mentioned some of these programs and things that you can go on.
Yeah, look, you can definitely become worse if you don't want to change.
Yeah.
Again, Morne Harms is a good example, the sword killer. He did nothing for the first 9 years that he was there. He didn't even finish. He had 6 months of his matric left when he committed that crime. He never bothered to finish his matric in 10 years. Didn't do any, literally right towards the end, he suddenly realized, I better start doing some courses. He literally sat in his cell, watched TV. He worked for 6 weeks and then gave up in the upholstery section or something like that. So here's a guy who did nothing. So there can be these courses, and again, the quality of the courses is a whole separate argument. I have my doubts if they're necessarily good courses. I don't know if there's any evidence to show they work. That's the first thing. But I know a guy, for example, his name is Stefan Skutsia. Now, in 1996, he was one of the four people in Worcester that planted a bomb in the Checkers shopping center. They killed a number of people and injured countless more. So he was one of these right-wingers. He went to jail. He was literally caught almost immediately along with his colleagues. I think he pled guilty or was sentenced very quickly. And he spent, I think, 19 – he was 19 years old then. He spent 19 years in jail and was released in 2015. He went through his own whole sort of de-radicalization process. Because of people he met in the prison, not the staff per se, actually other prisoners, who helped him move away from that radicalized viewpoint, who helped him embark upon the whole restorative justice. And he's actually literally the poster boy for restorative justice. He met with all the victims that survived, the families of those who didn't survive. And in the end, all of them, we're talking about a few hundred people, said, you've got to release this guy. That wouldn't have happened if he hadn't had that desire to be someone different. Mm. And he didn't have any fancy programs. He didn't have a de-radicalization program. I mean, we still don't have that in our prisons in South Africa. So if you want to change, and he actually said it because he spoke at a conference the other day. He said, if prison doesn't change you, nothing will.
Mm. So what happens if you get thrown like in a maximum security, like in Kokstad, like border Eastern Cape, KZN?
Yeah, yeah.
Like where you have a room tiny and like no interaction, like solitary confinement for 15 years, 10 years. Those are the stories coming out. Do you change in that?
You'll change, but not necessarily for the better. So just sitting in a cell is, it can change you in the sense I don't want to be back here again. But that might not necessarily change you. It might just make you realize, although I have my urges and desires, I really don't like what happened to me. So that's hopefully a reason not to do it. It doesn't mean you've actually changed as a human being.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. That's so the, negative, that's where the punishment side.
Yeah, negative reinforcement.
Yeah. But you might still have the urges to do whatever it is that landed you in prison in the first place.
But the consequences.
But you think, I don't want to. I just want to get on my life. I don't want to face those consequences. But you haven't actually changed. So if you don't have that will to change, and also proper professional evidence-based programs that are there, we won't see that change. And I'm a firm believer that we have to. I know people say, "Well, people must sit in rotten jail." Almost every single person who gets sent to jail will come out. Even if you've got the multiple life sentences, you probably will come out at some point. So the question is, if we throw people in jail and say, it must be a horrible place where it needs to be like tortured literally every day, just being there, not being tortured, then we can't bitch and moan when that person comes out and does something horrible. Because if you're going to treat someone like an animal, they will behave like an animal when they're released. And then we are the ones to blame. So, and I kind of had that switch in my mindset when I went to that private prison in 2006, because I just realized that, but these guys are going to come out. So we can satisfy our inner, yeah, great, you're in prison. We must make prisoners down mine shafts and you must never have fun. But we really do need to change people because they're going to come out. And the majority of prisoners aren't in prison for life. Even people who committed horrible offenses like rape and child molestation, you know, they might be released after 7 years if they get parole. So we have to really put a lot of emphasis on getting these people in education, helping change their mindsets, fix what we can fix, alter what we can alter, because they're going to come out. And we don't. And if they do commit crimes afterwards, and we didn't have a rehabilitative mindset, then we are to blame for what they do afterwards.
Yeah, I think that you said this at the beginning, and you're repeating it again effectively, that once someone goes into jail, it's really up to them if they want to get better or not. And a lot of people will just sit around for 9 years in their cell, sleeping all day. I mean, we don't really have activities for them to do. We don't put them on chain gangs and make them fix potholes.
Some of them can get jobs inside the prison. Prisons, some like Leeuwkopje in Midrand, you know, I think they have like an actual working farm that you might be able to participate in. I know Zonnewater used to have, you know, a furniture making factory. So there are some that have like almost like businesses, you can say, that you can participate in. Other times it's working in the local shop or in the cafeteria or the mess hall or just cleaning the floors. So there are things you can do. But if you don't want to, there's nobody going to force you to do anything. You can literally sit and watch TV, take drugs and play on your cell phone because everybody has cell phones.
They all have cell phones. Yeah. Well, that sounds like the average 20-year-old in South Africa anyway, without prison, but they've got all the other stuff going on that prisoners have.
They get to listen to Taylor Swift.
Except they have to pay for their own meals and accommodation sometimes, or at least their parents do. All right, well, listen, Gerard, this is always fascinating. I think loads of people with opinions about Oscar, but I'm glad that you've helped us to understand how the parole system works or doesn't work, as the case may be. And I think that there's huge room for improvement here.
Mm.
Because it seems that at the end of all of these processes, we're letting ourselves down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unbelievable. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
Always good. And what a way to end this morning's show. There's lots of people who absolutely love this. Dr. Gerard Labuschagne. You can follow him on the social media at GN Labuschagne. All of that on cliffcentral.com too. If you missed any of this, we will be putting the podcast up for you later. Happy Tuesday, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Cheers. Bye-bye. Cliffcentral.com.